took a good old-fashioned bank run to expose just how poorly some banks have managed your deposits, and some deposits of the biggest tech companies, too. It all started with Silvergate, Signature, Silicon Valley banks, customers rushing to withdraw their money. The banks had that money tied up with unrealized losses. It's a perfect storm for banks to collapse. And it's not just those banks. One study shows that nearly 200 U.S. banks are at risk of the exact same kind of collapse. What do you expect in a fractional reserve banking system where the Fed cut the reserve requirement to zero? JPL did that back in March of 2020, and it's still zero. U.S. banks can literally lend an unlimited amount of money created out of thin air. And anyone who's ever watched Billions will know a bank charter is the golden ticket, keys to the money printer. So as regulators continue to debate and try to fix the banking crisis and prevent a global economic meltdown, we've done the unthinkable. We bought a bank. Today on Dumb Money, we'll tell you who, what, when, where, why, and the fun part, how it was way easier than it sounds. You're listening to the Dumb Money Live podcast. Chris Jordan, the title of today's show is a little misleading. I want to clarify right up front so nobody thinks this is clickbait. We did buy a bank, but the way we did it was buying shares of a publicly traded bank. But I think the thought process that went into picking the bank stock that seems to be a lower risk, higher potential return is an interesting one. And we're just tiptoeing into this trade. Chris, I know you made a small initial investment, but you're looking to potentially get in bigger, right?
Here's why my investment was small. I think people forget one thing when it comes to banks. There's not a single bank in the world that can survive a bank run. Not a single bank. That's just something we really haven't had to worry about in the past, because we all kind of pretended that our deposits were insured, even though they aren't technically insured. And this like pushed that test to the limit, right? Like,
it's kind of the perfect storm of two things.
Pretty much, they are protected unless you put in more than $250,000 to a checking or a savings account. In which
and case, what business can operate in a bank?
Well, that's the problem, right? And so that's the problem. It's not individuals. Some individuals do keep more than $250,000 in a checking account, and for them, I say anything over $250,000, put it in a money market. Now, the businesses that actually have operating capital in far in excess of $250,000, that's where things get dicey.
But Jordan, what's so amazing is that so many businesses, I would say most businesses and most affluent individuals with over $250,000 in a bank just didn't care until like 30 days ago whether or not their deposits were truly insured or not. I mean, you know, all of our...
And they just assumed, whether insured or not, they assumed a bank equals safe, because we just...
I've heard a few CFOs that actually recently consolidated, you know, their banking, right? Where they used to have, you know, maybe deposits spread across five or six banks, and they had recently consolidated to one. And so now, you know, I bet every single CFO right now is like, okay, well, we've got to reconsolidate, or we've got to unconsolidate everything and spread things around just so that we have operating capital in case of a default.
Correct. Jordan, almost all of our portfolio company that have millions to tens of millions of dollars in cash that was raised from investor had all of their money at a single bank. A lot of them at Silicon Valley Bank, right? In addition to that, small business, because Dave, you know, you're an owner of a small business like me.
Yeah.
My restaurant often has more than $250,000 with our community bank. We might have $400,000 or $500,000 with our community bank. Now, we split that into two accounts a few weeks ago for safety, but that's just the mindset. Most businesses work with a community bank or regional bank, and they might have anywhere between a few hundred thousand and a few million dollars. Larger companies have tens of millions, and you just have it with that bank. You're not really worried about this because it hasn't been an issue.
And you just think that a bank equals like a vault. You think your money is just being locked away. You're not really thinking about what they're doing with that money, which is loaning it out and buying bonds with it. And when you have the bond interest rates going up and the price of those bonds going down, you get into a real problem if someone starts inspecting your balance sheet, which is exactly what happened with Silicon Valley Bank.
So there's that overriding risk that at some point something triggers a deeper bank run. Maybe it's a commercial real estate collapse, maybe it's something else. But now that we're keenly aware of the fact that our money is not insured above $250,000, unless the government chooses to backstop that individual bank's depositors, we are all going to go racing to pull anything over $250,000 out of that bank and put it into something that's secure, whether it's investing across multiple banks or putting that money into a treasury-backed security. So that said, that's a real risk no matter what bank you're in. Okay, I need to invest in a bank regardless of that risk because banks are a money printing machine and most banks at this point are down 30 to 60%. Okay, so for me, I'm willing to allocate a very small portion of my portfolio into the banks now that they've had this haircut under the assumption that there is a chance that we will eventually get out of this mess without continued bank runs. But if I'm going to do that, I want to invest in the bank with the best balance for this atmosphere that we're in right now, right? I want the bank that most investors are going to be thinking is not real that at risk to either long-dated securities that they are forced to sell at a loss or a large percent of commercial real estate loans, specifically in the office sector, which seems to be the highest risk sector of commercial loans right now, that I think could be the next shoe to drop that everybody is concerned about.
And also, just like the third factor there is what percentage of their depositors typically have more than that FDIC limit, right? And I saw an interesting, Christian Bale tweeted, also known as Michael Burry, tweeted this chart and then deleted it, but thanks to the internet, it still exists. And it's this really cool chart that shows the x-axis is the unrealized losses on bond portfolios at these various banks, and the y-axis is the percentage of deposits over 250. And if you look at the risky quadrant on the top right, you see Silicon Valley Bank, you see, these are the risky ones. And then the quadrant you want to be in is that lower left quadrant where you see a few of them. My eyesight isn't good enough. I'm going to have to zoom in. But basically, you see CFG, which is Citizens Financial Group, PNC, which is the PNC Finance Service, a PNC bank, NYCB, which is New York Community Bank Corp, which did take over some of Signature Bank's deposits and loans, and their stock jumped. And then MTB, which is M&T Bank Corp. Not on this chart is the First Citizens Bank shares, which is FCNA, which they bought some of SVB's assets, and their stock also jumped.
So let's talk about this graph because this went viral. And there's other similar charts and graphs that essentially the same thing as this graph. And everyone's kind of looking at this going, okay, who's the safest? Who's the safest? And M&T Bank keeps coming up again and again and again. So I think sometimes it's the perception of safety more than safety itself that matters in scenarios, because assuming that we start to see any type of recovery or settling in the banking sector with regional banks and these bank runs start to slow down, which I hope they will. Everyone's going to rush in those banks that they feel are most likely to survive the next category of risk, which commercial real estate. And M&T Bank seems to be like they're in a very good position there, according to that chart. Now, the chart doesn't tell the entire story, right? Because loans that are at risk are loans that the bank has identified to be at risk. With commercial real estate loans, what people are saying is that a lot of those loans in those portfolios have not yet been marked down. So the banks have not yet admitted to having, potential defaults in their portfolio. And at some point that's going to happen. And that's where all the concern is right now in regional banking. Okay, so I did some deep dive research. And it appears, according to their own statement, that M&T Bank, of the 170 billion dollars of assets, something like that, they only have $5 billion invested in office commercial real estate, which is my big area of concern. Of that $5 billion, they have marked 20% of it, so $1 billion of that is at risk. And they have been pretty clear about this. The thing that's interesting about M&T Bank is they are super conservative. In fact, they are one of the very few banks that have been profitable, I think, every quarter since the 70s and did not decrease their dividend even during the 2008 financial collapse. They do not have a lot of long dated as it relates to treasury. So I think most of their treasuries are like 1 year or lower. So they're good to go there. I do like that they've been very clear about their commercial real estate portfolio. Specifically, they've had major issues with the hotel portion because they have a lot of hotels in New York. That was the concern for M&T Bank. That portfolio of loans has gotten better as people started going back to hotels. So they appear to be safe there. But there's $1 billion that they marked at risk. It doesn't mean they're going to lose $1 billion, but it's $1 billion at risk within their office portfolio. Now, in that office portfolio, they've also stated that the vast majority of renewals for offices are 2024 or beyond. So it's not like we're going to see a lot of office rules come up this next year that might reset at a lower lease rate, which would impact their balance sheet. So I can't see anything, at least in my visibility. And again, we're not financial advisors. This is just us making a decision for ourselves, guys. So please poke holes in our thesis, do your own research. Do not clone our investments here. But I have not been able to find anything in the M&T Bank balance sheet that is pretty concerning, that would be devastating, right, to this bank in the short term. That doesn't mean that they're not going to have a huge number of withdrawals, right? Because this bank run, we yet don't know we don't know the percent of their portfolio above $250,000 that is withdrawn over the past few weeks. That would be an area of concern and impact their ability to maintain a deposit base. But again, the stock is down, what, Dave, 40%, roughly? 40-45%? I think, in my opinion, this has to be one of the safest. I know it's a relative term, but M&T Bank has to be one of the very safest community banks out there. And if I have to own a bank, and I chose that I had to own a bank, because I want to put some money at risk here in this sector, because I believe it's more likely to recover than not, I chose to do it with M&T Bank and one other that I'll discuss later. So what do you think about that?
Well, I'm with you on this one because I also wanted some exposure to a bank stock. It seems like to me, when you see stocks that are beat down like this in a sector, in an industry that has the unlimited money printer capability, and if we kind of don't think that the government or regulators are going to allow regional banks to fail, they're not in the too big to fail category. And my personal money is at Bank of America. My business's money is at Chase. I don't have a regional bank relationship, but I don't think that regional banks are going to be really at risk beyond what's already happened, right?
Yeah, look, I mean, so banks
are at risk. They have to commercial real estate.
Only one of you at a time. Jordan, you go first. Say it again, Jordan. We're talking on top of each other.
It's letting the banks fail. So that's what they're doing. They're saying, you know, we might backstop depositors until we don't. And we're going to let the equity holders take all the pain, right? And then even the bondholders, they're letting take some pain. It depends on where you are in the, on the credit risk side of the bond issuance. But yeah, I mean, I just don't think that there's a reason to try to jump in here and be a hero.
But I think MTB of the banks.
What?
I think of the banks, MTB is in the position of not being the risky play. They have been very conservative with the way they operated their banks.
That's fine. I mean, that's not how I allocate my money. If that's how you allocate your money, the best of the worst, that's fine.
But Jordan, they also are paying a 4% dividend yield. So I know that that's attractive to you.
But you could get that risk free in your money market account. So
I know.
Yeah. So Jordan, I generally agree with you. I don't like the banking sector here. I don't like regional banks here, particularly. I think there is still risk, and I think the government has come out and said we're not going to protect investors.
Right.
And that is really risky if we continue to see outflows on uninsured deposits. There's no doubt about that. And I think that's the biggest risk here of investing in any of these regionals is continued outflows. You can't fight that. You just can't fight that. If all of your depositors withdraw, you're in trouble no matter what. So the question is, this bank has been around since, I don't know, 1840. right? Something like that, 1860. They have a really deep-seated depositor base. They have strong relationships with their depositors, with their commercial clients. The thing here that everyone has to remember is you can't just kind of leave your commercial, your community regional bank if you're a business, because like we're not, like my restaurant, we're never going to do business with Bank of America, right? It's just not going to work.
But I just think there's a bias. I think you've got a bias here, and I think it's a recency bias where you're looking and you're like, okay, well, who's not going to have a bank run? And then they are probably going to be successful. But 3 months ago, you would never have said that the bank, you know, that doesn't have a bank run is the most successful. I think you still have all sorts of risks, like you said, in their loan portfolio. But, you know, yield curve inversion doesn't tend to work out well for financial institutions. And so I just don't think it's a good time to invest in banks.
I Jordan, I totally agree.
You don't have to go out of business for it to be a bad investment, right? That's my point.
That is true.
I totally agree. I do think that there is a better than 50-50 chance here. You know, that's just me. That we get through this banking crisis, being able to identify where the bad loans are through this next quarter. When bank comes out with, you know, when the banks start coming out with earnings, we're going to start to see exactly how badly they were hit by the run. I think that bank run has dramatically settled over the past week or so, and I just don't think we're going to continue to see a massive run on the bank unless something else, the other shoe drops, right? And it could.
Yeah, I agree with that. I saw a chart, and I don't remember exactly where it was, so you know, take this with a grain of salt, but basically it was showing that like regional bank deposits were dropping, and then they've kind of rebounded. And so that's what I already said. Just because the first problem was bank run on Silicon Valley, and then, you know, whatever happened to First Republic, and then, you know, SBNY and Silvergate, and we've had four either failures or near failures in the last what started maybe like 3 or 4 weeks ago. I don't think it's over.
You're listening to the Dumb Money Live podcast.
I'm not a long-term investor in the banking sector either. If we get this rebound, I'll likely be out of M&T Bank. It does not necessarily fit my social arb methodology, but you know what? I'm playing it. I'm buying the best of the worst.
That's where I see this. The banking sector in general right now is not where I would put my money, but we've seen a pullback and we have seen a risk assessment and going in that lower end of the risk kind of makes sense to me.
There are two other banks that I bought. One of them is JP Morgan. My rationale there is just the tremendous inflow of deposits, the tremendous inflow of commercial deposits, of high net worth deposits. When I was down at South by Southwest a couple weeks ago and all this was going down, you know, we all heard the rumors. There were a lot of, you know, JP Morgan Chase kind of affiliated people that were all kind of swirling around saying that they had actually, I think, a 25% increase in like 5 days of their deposits on their high net worth wealth division, which is just absolutely insane, right? The vast majority of money that was coming out of Silicon Valley Bank and some of the others were all flowing into JP Morgan. They were working 24/7 just to bring in new clients. I think that is a huge, huge win for them. As we know, they're just banking with them is not fun if you're not an extraordinarily large client, right? So they don't pay you anything for your money. You're going to get paid nothing on your deposits, right? You're going to receive virtually no service. But they had this massive inflow due to safety. And people don't like switching their bank every few weeks, right? So a lot of that is going to stick for a while.
How is there not a bank or some version of a bank that like is just literally is a bank vault where your money is in a brokerage style money market, but even then that gets loaned out? I mean, how is there not just a safe place to put your money? That doesn't make sense to me.
There is. So I was talking to the head of a bank a few days ago at a venture conference that's a digital bank, but they insure your deposits up to $150 million by essentially, and there's a few banks that do this, that spread it across hundreds of banks, right? So at $250,000 a piece. And you pay a very small fee for that, you know, call it insurance or a small premium. And it's well worth it. But that product is out there. There are banks that offer that product. And more so than ever, people are asking for it. And it's a great product because, like, you're done, right? I think you pay like 0.14% premium to have your money maneuvered around, and you have to complete, you know, an application to inform the bank where else you have money so they don't duplicate it at the same bank that you might have another account at. But you can have your money insured across hundreds of different banks at the $250,000 cap. So it's a product that's out there. And you could also just buy treasuries, Dave. I mean, that's the safest thing in the world to do. You don't have to worry about any of this stuff. And you get like, what, 4%? On a treasury.
It depends on where you are on duration. But yeah, I mean, so, you know, money market is obviously instantly liquid. But any of the actual treasuries, you're going to have, you know, credit rate risk. But, you know, but that's...
Well, and I think the problem with treasuries for businesses that have raised money, you can't just lock that money away for 10 years or even 2 years or even 30 days because you might need that money to make payroll.
Any time. In fact, so bigger companies have treasuries. I mean, you know, that's what they do with excess capital. But they have an entire team that manages those things. And they, you know, they're not just saying like, oh, let's roll the dice on $1 billion of, you know, long-term 30-year, you know,
bonds. Keep them short.
They have a ladder set up and they've got strategies for all this.
It's not difficult. You keep them short dated, and it's the safest thing you could have your money in, right? And so, like, none of this is difficult. And that's the problem, Dave. The problem is that people are waking up to the fact that they do have options that are completely safe. So why would you keep, you know, $5 million sitting at a regional bank, not earning all that much interest, which is quite often the case, right? Quite often the case. In fact, I even looked at M&T Bank to see what they were offering depositor. And it looks like up to $10 million, I could be wrong, they pay 2.96% interest, right? So if they're paying 2.9, and that's an intro rate, if they're paying 2.96% interest to depositors, and that's between $10,000 and I think it was $10 million. So they're earning more than 2.96% on their money, right? I mean, it's not hard to get more than 2.96%. So they actually have a net interest margin, which is the money that they make on deposits, of roughly 4%. So M&T Bank has a 4% margin between their borrowing cost and how much they're making, right, as a regional bank. And that's why I said I want to own a bank, because historically, banking is a great place to be. It's a money printing machine. And so many of their accounts are under the FDIC limit. They are fully insured. And a lot of those depositors are earning 0%. Most of these banks pay most of their customers 0%.
Well, and I was just checking M&T. This is for personal. Their My Choice Money Market is currently paying 0.0203. The introductory rate is 0.3 on up to. But once you have more than $10,000, they're paying 2.96. But that's an introductory rate. The regular rate is 0.02%.
This is why you want to be in banking, as long as people don't wake up to the fact that there's a better option. So, Jordan, the only question here is what percentage of the customer base that has deposits over $250,000 is going to wake up to the fact that there are better and safer options out there? I don't have the answer to that question, but I think we're going to settle that in this next earnings call across every single bank, and we're going to figure out how much money was pulled out of these banks. How bad is it? I don't know. But
it could be slightly impactful to Noodle, right? So if you think about it, let's say that you've got, let's say that you're a business and you've got $10 million in XYZ bullshit bank, right? And you just say, you know what, we're going to split it up into five banks and only have 2 million in each five banks. And so in that case, if they're all just spreading it around to regional banks, then any outflow will be an inflow for another bank, and maybe it just kind of neutralizes itself. Now, on the other hand, if, you know, companies figure out what their working capital needs are, and let's say of that 10, you know, their working capital needs are like $4 million, that maybe the other 5 or 6 million they can put in, you know, some sort of money market fund and actually get, you know, what, 3-4% rate, right? And so that would be the negative.
Yeah, I think, like I said, the real risk here is deposit rate in my mind. That's the risk here. I looked at their lending portfolio. I'm not particularly concerned. It's super diversified. They've been really conservative, always have been conservative with their lending portfolio. There is a little bit of risk there, but I don't think it's catastrophic. As long as their deposit base stays stable, I'm pretty comfortable with this investment. And as long as there isn't continued run on the banks,
I've said this before, and I stake beside it that I think that Silicon Valley, while they could have been under duress for a long time, would still be in business today if for the run.
Of course, but Jordan, that one can happen to any bank, and it could happen to all of them over the next.
Well, I think Silicon Valley was a unique situation, and you had some highly public figures letting you know that things were, you know, not in the best, you know, buttoned up situation at the bank. Tour, like, you're never going to have that with, you know, regional M&T bank. Like, there's not, you know, the Warren Buffett of M&T banks not going to come across and start telling everybody they're a depositor.
I don't think so either. Also, you have to remember in this, you were talking about the rate environment and what it does for banks. For banks like M&T that have a lot of their securities that are short term, this type of rate environment's actually been helping them as the rates go up, because their net interest margin has been growing, because now they're able to reinvest at higher rates. And again, as long as there is that has a caveat to it. As long as their depositors, again, are okay making a low rate of return on their deposits. And they have come out and said that the risk is that the cost of borrowing capital will go up. And that is a big concern. If everybody wakes up to the fact that they can earn 4% on a treasury bill, right, they're going to pull their money out of places where they're only making 2.9%. That extra percent is a lot when you have...
I agree. If you're using a checking account as a savings account, then yes, I mean, people are probably starting to get wise to this. But again, there is the difference, you know, there is the argument that you have to have a checking account and you have to have working capital in it to be able to operate. And, you know, even individuals operate, you know, kind of as a business now.
Yeah, but you only need so much money in that account, right? And if you start, you know, getting smart about it, the banks lose.
Right.
The banks want you being lazy and just sitting your money there because you don't know what else to do with it. And just money
is only a problem as long as we have interest rates, right? And so if the Fed starts cutting, you know, once we go into recession, I'm not saying if it is or isn't how long we're going to keep interest rates high, but this is only a problem as long as we have, you know, as the government's paying you to part their money with them.
Yeah. Okay. So
you're not in any bank.
You revealed that you've bought MTB and JP Morgan. You said you had two. You have one more. What is it?
These are all small investments, right? My third is Schwab. Now, Schwab does have a lending portfolio that appears to be at risk. I don't know the details of it, but smarter people than me have dissected kind of where they have their money, and it is long dated and it does appear to be at risk. However, Schwab has seen inflows during this period, not outflows. I think Schwab, while not considered to be a too big to fail, you know, traditional conventional bank like JP Morgan, B of A, Citigroup, they are the type of institution as a broker where people just feel comfortable with Schwab. And they have come out and said that I think the week that this all went down, I think they said they had three plus billion, or maybe it was 20 billion, some large number of inflows, which was really interesting to see. So again, none of this really matters with the long dated securities if you're able to keep your deposit base. And I think they are probably one of the stronger players there, and they continue to generate great income from their brokerage activities, obviously. I also think that they are perfectly suited in the brokerage sector. Now, for those of y'all that don't know, Charles Schwab bought Ameritrade. Ameritrade had previously bought Scottrade. So, you know, Schwab is now kind of like the mega online discount broker. And where Robinhood at one point in time was a huge risk factor for a company like Schwab and Ameritrade, does anybody really feel comfortable having a large amount of money in a brokerage like Robinhood right now, or any of those brokers that spun up during the last 4 or 5 years? Absolutely not. So
yeah.
I think Schwab is actually in a really good place in their industry sector to pick up a lot of accounts and get a lot of deposit inflow from people that are
So what do they have as far as deposits versus what they have under in like custodial AUM account? Do you know those?
I don't know. I don't know the specifics. I just know that they do have deposits, and they do have long dated securities, and they evidently haven't done the best job of managing that risk in terms of being conservative. From what the market is saying about Schwab. I'm not concerned, though, because the long-dated stuff works its way out as long as depositors don't flee. And it doesn't appear that anybody's fleeing Schwab, including myself.
What happened with Schwab's stock? This is not a stock that I follow, but it looks like right around March 9th and 10th, they dropped substantially.
Every single financial stock dropped because of the fallout from Silicon Valley Bank. And so
they dropped 40%.
The second drop? The first drop was from Silicon Valley Bank.
So Winning Trades just shared, you know, I haven't looked this up on Schwab in a couple of weeks, but Schwab has $11 billion in unrealized losses, right? And the majority of that is likely long dated securities. But obviously they don't have to sell any of those as long as they maintain their deposit rate, which they appear to be doing and adding to it. And of course, you know, like all the banks now, they're able to borrow from the Fed. When you're borrowing from the Fed, what people don't realize is the Fed, I think, is charging, what,
yes,
4.5%?
I don't know the percentage, but it's pretty much like normal interest rates these days.
Yes. So yes, these banks like Schwab can borrow, okay, to cover the withdrawals, the depositor withdrawals. But they're borrowing, if you're borrowing at 4.5%, okay, and those long-dated securities that you're in are, let's say, at 1.8% or 2.2%, right? You're taking a 2% loss. Let's say if Schwab has to borrow a $10 billion, right? They're taking, that's $200 million annualized loss on that, as long as they need to maintain that level of borrowing. I'm not concerned. Because it appears to be that Schwab did not have a major outflow. So hopefully Schwab does not need to borrow that much money and their earnings won't get meaningfully impacted. So I bought Schwab because I love it. I think they're just beautifully positioned in the brokerage sector here. I've kind of, you know, I bought Schwab before this. I've had to sell out of it, but now I'm back in Schwab after the drop. These are small investments, by the way, guys. So I do have some money in Schwab. I do have some money in JP Morgan. And on the regional side, which is kind of super scary, I do have money in M&T because I do think they are the strongest. But all three together is still a relatively small size piece of my portfolio.
You're listening to the Dumb Money Live podcast.
It's not bank related, but Apple just announced that they're letting you do a buy now, pay later on products. It's not really, they're not extending your credit.
Dollars, is that correct, Dave?
It is a $1,000 limit. You get to have that $1,000 spread out among four payments, so it just makes it easier to buy a $1,000 iPhone. No interest, but they're not really extending credit. They're just it was worded that they're not extending credit. They're just dividing the payments up, but I don't know how they're actually facilitating that.
I know for their regular loan program, it goes through a credit card company. Now it goes to that Goldman Sachs credit card is how they.
Well, that's their Apple card. Yeah, Apple card is Goldman, right. And their kind of buy the ability to buy and pay with without the credit card. They also had a Citizens First or one of the Citizens banks where they had their kind of subscription service for getting a new iPhone.
Yeah, so I don't know. I haven't read to see if they're doing this internally. I mean, they have enough cash to, or if they are using, you know, some other service. Like, I don't know.
Is this a positive or negative for Apple, though, or do we even care?
I think it's a positive. I think people have Apple as this aspiring brand that they want, and now instead of buying the cheapest phone because that's what they can afford this month, they can buy the Max or something for
The phone spread their legs. You want a watch? I mean, it's a perfect thing for a watch or a set of AirPods or something like that. You can just walk in.
Yeah.
And instead of having to outlay the full $300, $400, $500, you walk out. You only spend $100. You feel great, and you get hit, you know, for the next 4 months.
Can I bring up something that's just really pissing me off? It's unrelated to the market, but it kind of somewhat related to someone we talk about all the time, Elon. Dude, this announcement that he made yesterday about Twitter Blue, and if you don't pay the $7 or whatever a month, that
you're no longer included. You're no longer included in the For You page.
No, that
I'm sorry, man. That's
not true. You are included for people that follow you.
No, that's the follow page. There's two tabs.
No, he clarified later and he said you will be in the FU
page?
FYP page for people that follow you. So like if I follow you, Dave, you don't have the blue check mark, you will still show up in my For You page.
So Chris, you don't like this? I love it because I think there's so much junk on Twitter that I think when I retweet something, I think it's worthwhile. And for the followers that I have, I hope that they find that worthwhile. But I'm willing to pay $7 to be seen in the For You.
Dave, that is the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. First of all, your bots can easily pay $7. Junk accounts will easily pay
$7. Yes, they can, but not at scale.
But
a single bot account could absolutely do it. But it's these accounts that are just... spawning themselves out of nothing.
Great bot consolidation. And so you'll only have verified bots for now.
Yeah. Only high-quality bots.
You're missing out on all of the ideas coming from people all around the world that can't afford to pay $7 a month, and that sucks. The thing that makes TikTok so amazing is that we have like a billion people, and the algorithm is going to take someone who nobody would ordinarily see. Because the first 100 people that saw that video that person uploaded thought it was amazing and watched it 3 times. So now it's going to show it to a million people. And they go from a nobody to a somebody instantly. That's what I love about TikTok, is it's not biased in that way based on a person's social network.
Twitter, you don't just like go... Twitter's too clicky. Twitter's a click.
And this is going to make it way more clicky, Jordan. If someone has something to say and it's great and other people think it's great and they retweet it or like it or whatever, they should have equal amount of exposure to someone who's paying $7 a month. This is BS. He's saying it's about the bots. You know it's not about the bots.
It's about the revenue.
He wants the money, and it's ridiculous. It pisses me off so much. I don't think I'm going to do it.
But here's the thing. He needs the revenue. But it is a stopgap way of clearing out a bunch of junk content.
Honestly,
as soon as the Twitter algorithm gets as good as the TikTok algorithm, they don't need to do it anymore. But right now, their algorithm just isn't there.
Twitter's
algorithm is not as good as TikTok's.
I don't think there's that much junk content on Twitter that we need to do this. Okay, I'm on Twitter every day. I don't see that much junk content that we now need to charge everybody in the world $7 so that someone who's not following you can see what you have to say. I think that is ridiculous. Ridiculous. It pisses me off so much. Not for me. I can afford $7 a month. I don't know that I'm going to pay it. I'm not saying give me my final decision yet. But do you know how many people cannot afford to pay $7? They shouldn't.
I mean, it is kind of a random luxury product to have... $7 a month. Imagine if you had to pay all of your social media subscriptions $7 a month. It's kind of ridiculous, but for Twitter, just because it's just not as good as TikTok.
There is a way to verify without charging. This is not even verifying. I don't even think they really even verify you.
They verify you have a credit card.
There is an actual way to verify people if he wants to, if that's what he's worried about, right? That wouldn't cost them $7 a month. But that's not happening. This is a revenue thing. By the way, advertising dollars are down so much at Twitter. It's absolutely crazy. Like, it's going to get really interesting, even with the layoffs, how unprofitable Twitter potentially is going forward the next few quarters and what happens with that whole deal. And I think this is a desperation move. When I see him doing this, it feels so desperate to me that now I'm worried about, like, what's going to happen to Twitter? Now, he said there's going to be a new CEO this year, right? That has to happen.
Yes.
He's going to wait to the last second, obviously. It'll be like December 30th when he announces the new CEO.
If even, Elon Musk giving a date is just basically, you know, I could give you a date and it's going to be just as correct as his.
So wait, does him saying there's going to be a new CEO this year because he lost the Twitter poll, does that mean 2028?
It probably means next year or the year after that. It's really hard to say. I could shake an eight ball and it would tell me the future is fuzzy.
I mean, now I'm going to go Graham Stephan on you, but if you take that $7 and you put it in the market and compound it over 25 years, that's a lot of money for a lot of people, right? Like, it's insane to spend that money on Twitter. It's insane.
$7 times 12 months times 20 years is $1,680 for 20 years of Twitter satisfaction. That seems like a bargain.
I mean, it's $1,200. I mean, that's a vacation for some people.
You could argue with more people on Twitter.
$1,600. It's almost $1,700 in 20 years.
It's not a vacation. Let me just say this. It's not a vacation for me. And I want to warn everybody here, unless you just won the lottery, do not go to Baja Mar in the Bahamas with your family for spring break or any vacation ever. You are just a churn in the money wheel. Let me just explain this to you guys.
Don't go anywhere that has the word resort in it unless you've just won the lottery and you don't like paying $17 for a Diet Coke.
No, I want to say this to everybody here. The cost to feed your family of four at Baja Mar, which is, they have three resorts, the Grand Hyatt, the Rosewood, and the like SLS. It's all in one resort and it's like Vegas in the Bahamas, right? The cost to feed your family ranges between $800 and $1,200 a day, depending upon how much you drink. Now, we don't drink hardly at all, so it was closer to $800 a day. But I mean, we did not do anything crazy. We just had like a couple drinks a day and breakfast, and I don't even think we had lunch. We had dinner. That's how much it's worse than Disneyland, dude. It is so crazy. I don't know who can afford to do this. Like on a regular basis.
I think you did invite me to go on this trip, and I'm glad I declined.
Dude, never, never, ever, ever again. I tried to talk Amy into doing like a cruise next spring break. I just want to like do something all inclusive for Kath, and she said no. So I'm still working on next spring break, but don't go. Oh, Dave, how was the dog sledding? Do you want dog sledding? You know what?
I went to Nome, Alaska to catch the end of the Iditarod, which I don't know if you have heard of the Iditarod. It's kind of a big deal in Alaska, but it's a sled dog race, basically. It's 1,049 miles from Anchorage to Nome, where they have sled dogs pull a dude. It's this historic thing. It was actually really cool to see. The dogs were great. It sounds like, yeah, like PETA and stuff aren't really happy about this dog sled race, but seeing it firsthand, these dogs are happy, they're healthy. Even after doing 1,049 miles in a blizzard, they looked like they were ready to go another 1,000 miles. It was crazy. But I got to do a little dog sledding. I thought for sure it was going to be like a tourist version of doing it where they like just, you know, hook you up and let you do like a 50-yard dash and then it's over. No, they hooked up four dogs and a sled, and these dogs are trained. They know where to go, but they just took off. And
Just
with me. No
just
guy.
You?
Yes. It was insane. And I was just out there, and they tell you to talk to the dogs and sing to the dogs because it motivates them.
And they were just having a great time. And I was out for like 30 minutes just and made it back to the dog farm to I knew for sure that I was going to take a wrong turn and never make it back. But it was great.
You had to trust the dogs were going to bring you home. Like, were you not worried about other, aren't there like other terrifying animals out there?
There are. Yeah, there are. We didn't go anywhere near those. There was actually a mauling recently. Some guy got killed by, can't remember. It's a ram. It's like a giant ram looking thing with horns. I could Google it. I can't remember what it's called. But they kept us away from that. And we were really kind of more on a trail. Like, it was just all snow, but you could see the track lines of where, you know, where it was like a loop. So I was not really too concerned, but it was super fun. We saw that. We did that. We saw the end of the thing. We saw some northern lights. What else do we do? Oh, have you ever been? They call it snow machining. I think it's the exact same thing as snowmobiles, but there apparently it's called snow machining.
Did you do it?
That is so fun. Yes. I backtracked from the finish line to the first checkpoint, the last checkpoint before the finish line. It's called safety, and there's a bar there, and so I took my snow machine to there, had a cocktail, and then snow machined home.
So, Dave, let me just ask you, how much does something like this cost? Because I'm trying to figure out, is this a better solution for me in the future going dog sledding?
So I did it with a tour, and the tour was like $5,000 a person, which included the activities and the accommodations and meals. Mind you, the meals in Nome, Alaska, there are exactly 3 restaurants in all of Nome and 5 bars. These 3 restaurants are all pretty much identical, and their menu consists of burgers, pizza, Japanese, Korean, Mexican, like all the food groups, all at one restaurant run by, I think, the same family runs all 3 restaurants.
Was it good? Decent?
It was better than it sounds. I thought for sure this is going to be.
I guess I'm tired from, like, you know, dog sledding. Everything's good, right?
When they told me that we're going to a restaurant called Airport Pizza, and that when I opened the menu, the first thing was lasagna and tacos and salads, and I was like, this has got to be just the most generic cafeteria food ever. But it was actually pretty good. I'm not going to fly to Nome to go there just for dining. But it was good.
It sounds cold. Jordan?
Yeah, we actually had quite warm weather for this time of year. It was like the highs in the 20s, lows in the negative 8 to 10-ish range. One day, like the day we were supposed to leave, there was a big blizzard that hit and our flights all got canceled and we were stuck in Nome for an extra day. And it was cold and super windy that day. It was actually fun to walk outside and feel like the wind is pushing you backwards.
That sounds like
$5,000 a person plus airfare to get there, and because it's Nome, it's so far away, it takes 3 flights, so your chances of having one canceled are really good. On my way out, my flight from Dallas to Seattle was canceled, and that screwed up my entire trip, and I was going to be like, the next earliest flight they could get me on was 3 days later, so that would have screwed up even being able to get to the tour. So I had to buy a whole second set of airfare for like $2,000 and get out that day. So
it still sounds like you beat me.
Still very affordable compared to what you did.
Jordan, did you go on spring break? Or I know you've had some fitness stuff. So I think, not to get into your stuff, but I want to remind our viewers about what I think is a really important charity. Jordan, could you direct us to the best place if anybody wants to donate to, I know, a cause you're passionate about that could kept you home over the past couple weeks?
Yeah, it's Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. So our little girl Abigail has cystic fibrosis, and you know, this spring break was, you know, not a huge vacation like a lot of people got to have. So vacation to a hospital for, you know, some lung infections.
Well, our prayers are with you, man. She's out right now, and hopefully she's doing okay.
Yeah, I hear her running around right now.
Yeah, so what's the foundation again? What's the best one to donate to?
Cystic Fibrosis Foundation.
Okay.
And every year I do a fundraiser with the cycling event, but I think they're killing that. And so I'll be looking for other ways to get involved with them.
Well, whenever your next fundraiser is, we'll definitely need to hype it up on the show. And because we've got a following that would actually probably be able to top your fundraising effort.
Definitely. Definitely.
It's we might do like the walk, or I think there's climb. We'll find something to raise money for the CF Foundation.
Kills me, dude. Kills me. By the way, reminds me of something in healthcare that is that my most passionate healthcare investment. It's not as important as that, but Novo, man, have you guys seen Novo stock? My goodness,
gosh,
it just keeps going and going and going.
It's like, I have something right now.
It's at like 158 or something. Dude.
Yeah,
unreal. I wish I owned more. I should have bought. Look at that move.
It is skyrocketed. That X on the chart is where I bought it, thinking, oh, there's no way I'm buying it like an all-time high. But look, it's continued to, it's just really rocketed here at the end.
Yeah.
So I have my kids' college education brokerage accounts invested so concentrated. They only own two stocks. And I looked at how much their accounts were up in the past, like, couple weeks. I was like, this is insane. They are invested basically 50% in Novo and 50% in NVIDIA. I don't know if that's responsible of me to
First of all, that is not responsible. As a non-financial advisor, I can tell you that putting your kid's college fund in a concentration of two, a tech stock and a biotech, that sounds insane.
But I'm only doing it because if something catastrophic happened, I would backstop them. Okay, so I am the Fed. I am the Fed when it comes to their college savings account. So I want their accounts to aggressively grow because you know how much I hate college, and I don't even want them going to college. But if they choose to go to college, I really don't want to have to pay for it.
Not to go to college, are they going to just get this in cash at graduation?
So I think that's a debate that me and Amy are going to have. I would love for them to go to trade school.
You can use it for any type of education, right? So trade school, anything like that would be totally valid.
Education, or if they want to buy like a sprinkler repair company or a plumbing company, if they want to. But you've been talking about that sprinkler repair company for so long.
Get a tax hit for taking it out for a non-education purpose. But
I don't know, Jordan. So I have it in a custodial account that I think.
It's not your 529 account?
No.
You just have to figure out whatever the gifting rules are. Because they're titled in your name, or are they titled in their name?
In their name.
Oh.
It's in their name. Yeah.
Oh, well, then so maybe it's totally fine.
But I have 5 years to like 6x their money. So, you know.
Yeah. You should be able to do that. What, your annualized returns are what, like 15% or something?
Historically, 67%. I don't think I'm going to continue doing that now in this environment. But. Who knows? Between Novo and NVIDIA, if they keep moving, you never know. So I'm investing aggressively on their behalf. But yeah, their accounts are up so much. I was like, what has happened? And I forgot I put them in just those two stocks that are both really killing it. AI guys, did you watch the video that I sent you guys about how AI is going to kill us all?
Yeah, I listened to it. I just put it on my headset and walked around the house.
I have not watched it yet, but I plan to. And you can't send me a long form video and expect me to watch it immediately.
Yeah,
send me a TikTok and I'll watch it all day long.
So that's why I put it on my phone on YouTube and just put it in the background and then put the headphones on. And then whatever you're doing, you know, wash the dishes or whatever.
But Jordan, it's good, right? It's entertaining.
Actually, so what I appreciate about that guy, and I feel like we're kind of, you know, like inside, but what I liked about him is that he told us exactly where, you know, the weaknesses of his opinions are, who disagrees with him. And so to me, that validates, you know, who he is and that he understands all of the different positions that are out there and that he happens to have certain positions, but he's willing to discuss. And so I thought he was a really interesting person.
So guys, just so you know, it's titled, I'm going to put it in the notes here, We're All Gonna Die. It's episode 159, We're All Gonna Die with Eliezer Yudkowsky.
Yeah, it's episode 159 of the Bankless podcast.
Yeah, Bankless podcast. Yeah. Is it the Bankless podcast? Is that what it is?
Yep.
Yeah. So episode 159. Okay. So
should we do a reaction video to it?
I think we should at some point, honestly. Like I really want to do that because Jordan, would you agree that his thesis has legs? It's not ridiculous at all. Like it has legs. I'm not saying it's gonna happen, but he has a valid thesis that you have to respect somewhat.
So what he's brought up that I've heard other mathematicians bring up before is that the kind of the way that these models work with parameterization, it's like we fine-tune them to get them to give the results that we want. But there's, you know, we really don't know what they do and like why the parameters that we choose are the ones that, you know, optimize the model in certain ways to give the results that we want. And so that leaves open, you know, this unintended consequence issue, right? And so that's where, you know, I identify with what he's talking about.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we should do an episode on that because it's honestly, guys, you got to watch it. It's incredible. It's scary. You probably won't sleep well after listening to it or watching it, but I don't know. Eyes wide open. You got it. You have to know both sides of the AI story. There's a lot of incredible stuff with AI, but there is a real risk. And when you hear people talking about how AI is going to destroy the world, you're like, but how and why? This kind of breaks down how and why.
All I want to know is when, because I think I'm fine.
It sounded like it's in the not too distant future. Like I'm thinking, like Jordan, would you say he's probably thinking 5 to 20 years from now? Probably?
I would think he's probably thinking 10 to 30 years.
10 to 30 years, and we're done. Yeah. So let's end on that note. I do have a meeting I got to run to, guys. So we're gonna have to end on that note.
It's all around with that. Thanks for watching. Maybe we'll see you around.
Make as much money as we can until that happens. Okay.
In the next 5 or so years. Or maybe it all ends tomorrow. We're Dumb Money. Hope to see you soon.